you should always make your life be set up first and then have your loans match your life and not the other way around. Welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, I've named our episode how Vanguard and other robo-advisors are costing Americans billions of dollars. And it's a little bit of a jokingly named clickbaity title, if you will, because I do not at all mean that there's some sort of nefarious activity going on with Vanguard or robo-advisors or any kind of other big mutual fund companies. What I'm instead saying is the other title for this podcast was going to be Sins of Omission. What are you doing instead of sins of commission, which is what you're doing that's wrong? What are you not doing that you should be doing that's putting you in a bad position? For example, here's kind of the premise of today's episode, and I want to set it up kind of like this. So recently, I wanted to increase my automatic contribution to my Vanguard investment accounts because we're doing pretty good here at Student Loan Planner this year. We're helping a lot more people than we ever had. We're having tons of people refinance, and knock on wood, the income went up a little bit because we've been helping more people. So, okay, you got more money, you can spend it and, you know, buy a, I don't know, what do rich people buy? A fancy car or something. So you can do that, or you can save it and invest it. And so if you have plenty of money in the bank, then it's probably a good idea to invest your excess savings in some things. My wife and I were maxing our retirement accounts. So when you have maxed your retirement account, the next thing you need to do is put money into non-retirement accounts, which means that you have to go out somewhere and literally set up an investment account that you are in charge of, or you hire somebody to tell you to invest with them, and they're going to be the ones that are going to be setting that up, and you're going to have to manually make that decision to do that, and then you're going to have to set up a recurring transfer if that's the way you want to do it. Alternatively, you might just put a bunch of money in the bank and realize, oh shoot, I got $100,000 in here. I mean, I'm just talking in my redneck voice here. I got $100,000 in the bank, and I guess I better put it to work. So that's kind of like my some of my extended family members. They just wait until they have a randomly large amount of money in the bank and they realize that they need to invest it after the market's already gone up a bunch, which is not the way you want to invest. So the premise is, why is supposedly the website design of Vanguard, I think, costing Americans a lot in savings? Here's why. It is extremely difficult, and I hope somebody's listening to this podcast from Vanguard. That'd be great. Again, I love you guys. It's not critical. I'm just trying to make a point. On their website, it's so difficult to increase your automatic contributions. You have to go to My Accounts, and then you have to click on Account Maintenance, and then you have to click on this random tab that's kind of almost hidden in the bottom right-hand corner. It's called Automatic Investment. Then you can only do that for their mutual funds, so you can't use ETFs easily for automatic investments. And so the setup is so clunky. What does this really do? This is why it's fun to have such a large sample size of people that we've helped, because we really see some interesting data. High-income professionals, especially ones employed at places like hospitals that have great benefits, they're so good at maxing retirement accounts by and large. Like, everybody gets the idea that you're supposed to put a lot of money away for retirement, and so they'll put 10% in there, and if you're making 200 grand, you're going to hit that $19,000 cap. What's interesting is those very same people, they might be doing backdoor Roth IRAs, they might be putting a ton of money away in their retirement accounts, but they just don't know that there's these things called investment accounts that they can set up and have big automatic transfers, just like they transfer it out of their paycheck. And that's the reality, is things that are easy are very doable and always happen. Okay. So for example, the way that United Way got super popular was because they were one of the first organizations that figured out deducting money from employees' paychecks to give to charity. Honestly, they just made giving to charity simple. That's why they got famous as a charitable organization, not because they're a great organization. Maybe they are, but it's just because they made something positive very easy to do. So if I want to increase my automatic contribution with my Vanguard mutual funds, it's difficult. The website design is, again, it looks like it's something out of the mid-2000s. But why is Vanguard the best option for do-it-yourself investors? It's because their fees are the lowest. So they are the cheapest. And in reality, if you have the internal motivation to put money away for your future and realize that when you're spending an extra $2,000 a month in investments, you're buying back a couple years worth of your life, or maybe up to 5 years worth of your life that you can spend doing whatever you want. Because they're the cheapest, that's why I use them. Because I know that any money I pay extra in fees to an investment company, I'm reducing my long-term returns in a lot of cases by a lot. So because I'm focused on my internal motivation behind saving and investing, that's how I get over that hump. But for most people, it's not that easy because you have other things going on and you're not, you know, in love with investing and managing your money because you like doing medicine or dentistry or law, the law or business or whatever it is that you're doing, physical therapy. There's a lot of different options. I know we've got a wide variety of listeners. I better say veterinary medicine. Hopefully, you know, if you have any hate mail, feel free to send it to me, podcast@studentloanplanner.com. But how are other places doing this? How are other places preventing people from saving money because they make it too hard? So think about robo-advisors. I love robo-advisors. This is Betterment and Wealthfront. So we have a referral link. You know, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/betterment, better, like better, and M-E-N-T. If you go there, you'll get a little bit of time managed for free, basically, if you go through our referral link. So why would you use something like a robo-advisor instead of something like Vanguard? The main reason I can think of is convenience, because they have a good website and they make it a little easier to save more money automatically. And that's, if you get nothing else out of this today's episode, it's a little bit of a random episode, but I wanted to do it because there's this field of behavioral economics and just inertia and just things being too complicated that prevents you from making good decisions. And that's what I wanted to tackle in today's episode, is how to make good decisions by making things very simple. Okay. So with the Warbo advisors, they make things simple. So the key is to not care about what they're investing in and just giving them money automatically. I know that sounds kind of crazy, but that's the right thing to do, is literally just increase your automatic contribution as much as you can. I tell people all the time, start off with $100 a month, because they have no minimums. So there's no reason why you shouldn't open an account today with $100 a month. I think Vanguard requires like $3,000 to open a mutual fund. So if you have absolutely no money, I want you to develop that habit of putting recurring $100 a month transfers away into some sort of investment account that's not your retirement account. And the reason is, if you are trying to listen to the radio, okay, you're in the car, you know, everybody puts on the radio sometimes in traffic just to see what's on, right? If you want to turn up the volume because your favorite song came on and you don't know where the button is or the dial is to turn the volume up, how are you going to turn it up? You're not going to know. Same thing is true for investments. If you don't develop that habit at an early age, putting money in on a recurring basis, then by the time you develop that habit and realize you should do that, you have $200,000 in the bank, you know, $400,000 in student loans, very little in retirement and very little in investments. And you're just wondering what the heck is going on and what happened with your, you know, the past 15 years of your professional life. So that's what we're trying to avoid by making things simple and encouraging you to invest more. You know, I think that a lot of times things can be very, very simple, and you just have to have that internal motivation to make them as simple as possible. That's why, and again, I have to tell you this legally, you have to consult your own fiduciary licensed financial advisor before you make an investment decision, right? So that disclaimer out of the way, when somebody asks me, like a friend or family member, what kind of investment approach that I would recommend, keep it super easy. Take VTSAX, which is the US stock market, and then VTIAX, which is the international stock market. Those are two Vanguard mutual funds that cost almost nothing to own them, like 0.05%, I think, or less even. They're almost free to own, so there's almost no management fees. And then split your stock money up between the two of those 50-50. And then for the bond part, you just want to take your age minus 20, and that's the percentage you want in bonds, and then there are other percentage you want in stock. So for example, a 30-year-old could want 30 minus 20 equals 10. So 10% in bonds, 90% in stocks. A 50-year-old would want 70% in stocks and 30% in bonds. You could also replace bonds with cash if you want to. It's not super, super critical. It just needs to be in something very conservative. And then sometimes, instead of VBTLX, Total Bond Market Index Fund, you know, if somebody's in a 40-something percent tax bracket, then I recommend municipal bonds, which are tax-free. Do you have the discipline, though, to put that money away automatically, and are you going to keep doing that? So, for example, if you go into, and this is any financial institution, but, you know, Vanguard site, the robo-advisors, especially like brokerages that make a lot of money on commissions, options, don't even get me started on like options brokerages. They make things super complicated, so that's a great way to make a lot of profits. Just know that a lot of times people try to make things really, really complicated when it's not that complicated, and they do so for reasons of profit. Perhaps we're guilty of this sometimes, when maybe some people could just manage it on their own. But I do think that student loans, you know, are very, very complicated, especially when you know everything there is to know about it. Managing investments and doing well in investments, particularly like outperforming the market, is extremely difficult. But saving a lot in investments and having a high net worth is actually relatively easy. And it's easy if you make it simple, because there's this thing called a nudge. So this is a good kind of topic of the week to think about. A nudge is this term that was basically invented, if you will, by Richard Thaler, who won the Nobel Prize from it. And it's basically a behavioral finance strategy for getting people to do something that's good for them by making it really, really simple. For example, you might have heard of a target retirement date fund. That is an example of a nudge, and that kind of idea came about because of Dr. Thaler's research. So that idea is, okay, in retirement accounts, you offer 20 different options, and if you offer 20 different options, most people just put a bunch of money in all of them and have a really bad investment allocation, or it paralyzes them from having so many choices, so they do nothing. So another way that you can see this is in the supermarket, when you have a bazillion different choices, you're going to choose, you know, to consume less. So for example, I think they did a taste test and they offered different numbers of choices and people consumed the most when they had, you know, two or three options or something like that. It's a little overwhelming sometimes, the decisions that we have to make in our lives, which is why something like having a high savings rate, which is so important, can be made so much better if you make things simple. Just as an aside, how could you make things simple for student loans if you were a policymaker? Well, you probably would want to make automatic income-driven repayment enrollment for people. So you'd have to opt out of paying based on your income instead of having to opt in. So that's an example of a nudge. And that's kind of what we see a lot of these problems with, sins of omission of people not signing up for the right income-based plan, right? Or they don't send in their income paperwork and all of a sudden their interest capitalizes. Oh gosh, do I get a lot of emails about that? You know, screw those people at the loan service, or they capitalize my interest. Sorry, I guess all my angry voices are redneck today for whatever reason. But, you know, oh, they capitalized my interest because, you know, I forgot to send in my paperwork. You know, sometimes people are kind of, they know that they messed up. But regardless, like, why should you have to do that? Like, why shouldn't it be automatic? Why do you have to actively do something when it should be kind of sought out for you? So, for example, like, there was just an announcement that President Trump is automatically forgiving all student loan debt for disabled veterans, and they're searching a database at the VA to find the veteran who has 100% disabled rating, and then they're using that to cross-reference against the Department of Education data to see if they have student debt, and if they are, they're automatically being forgiven. Now, prior to that, only about 20% of veterans were getting their debt forgiven if they were 100% disabled, and that's because there was an application that they had to fill out. Right? You had to fill out the application and it took a lot of time and it was kind of confusing. And so people didn't do it. And so that's a sin of omission. For example, going back to the name for today's episode, like Vanguard's website costing people billions. So if Vanguard simplified their website, made it easier to save and invest more, if whenever you logged on, you were encouraged to just save a higher percentage of your pay into the total US and international stock markets, that would be a wonderful thing, because America would be billions of dollars richer because of it. But instead, we have the system where, you know, I'm not saying that they're doing this on purpose, but the website's complicated and other people's websites are not great either necessarily. I don't want to pick just on them. And because of that, people are like, what do I do? Like, how do I invest? More people pitch you options trading and things like that on TV instead of explaining why you should just have a high savings rate. Like, E-Trade and like all the dancing baby commercials or talking baby commercials, instead of just making it clear that they'll make it really convenient for you to save and invest more, you know, the pitch is, you know, we have the best commissions, like we have the best prices. And to be honest, like, I think it'd be in people's best interest if you just made it super easy. That's certainly what we find with so few people having brokerage accounts, even people with higher incomes. So what other sins of omission are you committing right now? So if you are not saving enough money, then you are committing a sin of omission. You are not doing something that you need to do for your future. Most of us are not going to have pensions. A lot of us that are counting on, or a lot of us know that we probably shouldn't be counting on Social Security because they're paying out way more in future benefits than they're going to receive in payroll taxes, unless they really raise the payroll taxes or cut benefits or both, right? Because Americans' number of kids is that we're having per person is going down. And so naturally, you're going to have fewer people paying into the system. And so, you know, older people are going to have a harder time getting income if you have fewer people paying into the system. So a lot of us are committing these sins of omission where we're not preparing and saving enough for our future. So, you know, your kind of man on the street who makes $40,000 or $50,000 a year can kind of get away with having all of their savings be in their home, because Social Security is going to replace a much, much higher percentage of his earnings than those of you listening who are making more money than that, you know. And if you're obviously married, then that would apply to a higher earning spouse if you're married and have that spouse making a higher income, and maybe you're in a lower earning profession. We see that often, right? Like a teacher married to a dentist, or physician married to a social worker or something like that. A lot of times people that commit sins of omission do so because of scary things that happen around them. I'll give you an example. How many of us were investing in 2008? Not a lot of people. Not a lot of us, at least, were investing in 2008. Or if we were investing, you know, I was investing in 2008, but I was investing my lawn mowing money. My first stock I bought, I invested like $300 that I'd saved mowing my granddad's lawn. You know, I mean, that was not a lot of money to lose if it went down 50%. And so in 2008, I remember there were retirees coming in droves to the university I was at to listen to any business school professor that would talk about what was going on. My mentor and professor that I was a teaching assistant for at the time, he went to give a talk at a men's Bible study, and the pastor there told him probably be like 20, 30 people there. And this is the middle of like the Lehman Brothers situation. And instead of 30 people, he walks in the church and expecting to sit down and just, you know, kind of talk casually about the economy. And there's 1,000 people staring back at him, freaking out about the markets crashing. Then those people probably get afraid to contribute money for their future. And then they sit around and don't do anything. And they missed out on one of the greatest stock market booms in history if they did that. So that's why automated plans are important. That's why when we're doing a student loan plan for somebody, I want it set up in such a way where you can think about your student loans once a year instead of constantly. So that's one kind of thing. If you're thinking about your student loans constantly where you're losing sleep over it at night, you definitely need our help because that's something that should never be happening. I get nervous about my taxes. I think about my taxes, but I do so generally about once a year. So that's what we should have for you is something straightforward enough where you're worried about it, you know, once a year and you don't have to stress about doing something every day. That's a bad decision. You want, again, you want things to be simple. You want to avoid committing a sin of omission and doing something that's really good for you by making it really easy and simple. Sounds like a simple concept, but it's actually a lot more profound than that. So the reason why I know that whenever companies like really good companies like Vanguard make things hard and cost people money by having their savings rates be lower, I know that this is a problem because let me confess to you for a second, I do this myself. I get really worried sometimes when the market is high and I feel like, oh shoot, if I put a lot of money in, then maybe it'll drop. I mean, I'm human. I'm subject to emotions. It's important to realize that we all have those emotions. And so sometimes I will wait to put my cash to work in my brokerage account. Maybe it's just because I have other things to do. Maybe I'm visiting my parents or going on a vacation and I forgot to invest it. I forgot to keep that recurring plan. Or maybe I'm just thinking about market timing. So that's an example of if I'm doing that sometimes, somebody who's not in finance definitely needs to be doing that where they have an automatic recurring monthly contribution. So a perfect setup to avoid having complexity cost you a lot of money is max your retirement accounts, take $19,000 a year, which is the maximum for 401ks and 403bs, and divide it by the number of paychecks you get a year. That's what you want to make sure you're putting aside every paycheck. For your non-retirement accounts, select one of these companies that we talk about on the podcast all the time and just set it up where you're doing $100 a month initially. And then once you have 6 months expenses in the bank and you don't have any other big financial goals, take leftover money and increase it automatically where you're putting in at least, you know, a significant amount of money every month. And then you can always decrease it or increase it if your income goes up or down. You know, I think that for financial services companies in general, when you're thinking about what kind of companies to work with, you either want to go with one that is really low cost and does a very good job for what you pay because it's the cheapest, because you have the internal motivation to learn how to do it all yourself and you just want a little bit of extra service to do something very basic. So for example, if you have $5,000 a month you want to put into mutual fund accounts, you don't care if the website is really lousy. You just want to make sure it costs as little as possible because you already have that internal motivation. It's kind of interesting the way this stuff works because with degrees, I mean, I'm going to be kind of honest for a second. You know, a lot of degrees kind of market that they're so different when in fact they're just commodities. So if you're listening to this before you borrow, I always tell people, go to the cheapest in-state school you possibly can, because ideally, I would like everybody to be able to make enough money to pay back their debt and for the math to make sense to pay back their debt. I mean, I don't think forgiveness feels good, which is why we have so many people call us freaking out. You know, I mean, refinancing and paying your loan debt off, you know, if you're on our email list, I sent this video out of this woman who paid off $220,000 and she was dancing in like this weird glowy spandex suit. Like people don't do that for putting money away in mutual funds. I sure wish they did though. Getting back to this idea about degrees, one of the things I think that tricks us into borrowing so much money for student loans is because schools kind of tell us about the difference, right? The fill in the blank difference, the university of so-and-so difference. And what they're trying to do is basically take a commodity and try to convince you that it's this brand and people pay more for brands because of marketing and perceived value. So for something like ibuprofen, I mean, buy the cheapest one. It's the same freaking thing, right? I mean, it doesn't get any more generic than pharmaceuticals. You know, if you're going to go with some other ideas or other options, I mean, there's all kinds of examples of this where a commodity is you want to either buy the cheapest one or you want to buy the one that's the highest convenience. Maybe if your school is super convenient, then maybe it's worth the higher price. But let me give you an example. What do you call a dentist who graduated from the College of Dental College of Georgia versus one that graduated from NYU Dental? They're both called doctor. And the main difference is $300,000 to $400,000 of extra debt for the one that went to NYU. That's just kind of an example of being careful, making things simple, like don't overthink things and don't overassign value to things. If you're thinking about financial services companies of where you should get the best help versus the cheapest help, you want to get convenient help at a fair price, or you want to just get something that's a commodity at the cheapest price. So like index funds, you want to buy the cheapest index fund because that's what matters, is low cost. Now, alternatively, if something's really convenient, you know, you might pay up a little bit for the convenience factor. So for example, if you were going to put your money with someplace that makes it really easy to save, then I think that that's okay to pay up for. So as much as I hate it when people pay a lot of extra money for financial products like financial advice or disability insurance or, holy cow, life insurance, man, do I have a lot of people that are paying way too much for that. The reality is if you would not have done it otherwise, then that convenience factor of those people that hunted you down and made you do it and marketed to you and got you to actually buy the thing that you probably needed to buy, that was a good thing, even if you're paying too much. I want you to think about right now, what are you not doing in your life right now that you should be doing that you're not doing financially? So here's a couple of the most common examples of people dealing with the complexity of a billion different options and not going with any of them. The first is to put at least 5% into your retirement accounts and eventually maximize it. Okay, so that's 5% to retirement. And then the second thing is recurring non-retirement investing. So again, studentloanplanner.com/betterment or Vanguard or something else. I don't care, but set up something where you're putting $100 a month into a non-retirement account and 5% of your pay into a retirement account. And then before that, you want to have no bad debt and having an emergency fund. Okay, those are some just a practical examples from today's podcast that you could apply if you're not already doing those things. Because if you're not doing those things, long term, you are hurting yourself. And hopefully you can help people make things really simple with their finances by just sharing people that pay off your bad debt, start your retirement accounts, contribute something that's not retirement accounts, and then with your student loans, figure out if it's a tax or if it's a debt. If it's a tax, you're going for forgiveness and you'd rather pay 10% on your income on your loans rather than paying it off with a huge required monthly payment. So here's just kind of a tip of my what I'm thinking about Student Loan Planner, you know, in terms of whether or not I want it to be the cheapest or the highest quality or whatever. You know, I want us to be the highest quality convenient option for a fair price to get student loan help. Don't necessarily want us to be the cheapest. Part of the reason for that is, do you want the cheapest ophthalmologist doing your eye procedure? Probably not, if it's important enough. And boy, oh boy, is your financial life important. And it is really, really easy to mess this stuff up. So if you would not trust the cheapest ophthalmologist messing around with your eyes, why would you let a financial person who has no idea what they're doing with your student loans make big decisions in your financial life? That's kind of my thought about Student Loan Planner. You know, if you are suffering from not taking key actions in your life financially that you know you need to take, then you probably need somebody to make it easy. And so if you're not going to have this magic solution where somebody's presenting you with the easy button, where they're just automatically signing you up for income-driven repayment, and it's just one option and it's very easy to do, if that's not the case, then you know you probably need some help to figure out the different complexities that are out there and figure out how to boil them down and make it simpler. Today, we have one little bonus question for you in today's episode. Remember, about studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. You can leave a recording with your question, and we're going to record one today, or we're going to give you one today from Jillian.
Hi, Travis and team. I am a physical therapist in the San Francisco Bay Area, making about $100,000 per year. I have $220,000 in student loan debt. I am about a quarter of the way through public service loan forgiveness. My husband and I just had our first child, and we plan on having about 1 to 2 more. Daycare runs about $1,800 per month per kid here. That being said, I think I'd like to take about 5 years off of working full time to care for my kid and my future kids. That would probably be in 1 to 2 years once future kids are here, and I should have 4 to 5 years of public service loan forgiveness under my belt. My husband is able to support the family on his paycheck, and we have about $60,000 in savings right now. We do have a mortgage, but our cars are paid in full. I know my time off will not count towards public service loan forgiveness. So my question is this a really bad idea? I know I'm not going to regret taking time off to raise my kids, but I fear losing public service loan forgiveness or just really extending the life of my loans and paying way too much extra. My husband and I file taxes separately. So will my payments be zero if I'm not working? Or do I need to go into forbearance or deferment if that's even an option? I've already scheduled a consult with Rob, so I know my more specific questions can be answered, but I'm hoping that this question can help some other folks here.
So that is a great question because, you know, what happens if life comes at you and derails your plans, and then all of a sudden something that you were kind of planning on doing, which is PSLF in Jillian's case, is something that you suddenly feel like you can't do, or the, you know, there's this huge monkey wrench thrown into the plan. For Jillian, you know, kind of to keep with the theme here, she has a sin of omission going on, which is that you don't actually need to worry about having basically periods of time counting towards PSLF that are not linked. And here's kind of why. So the worst case scenario is you'll be paying extra payments that are not counting, but the total cost will still be a lot less if you pursue PSLF. And just for example, if you're doing married filing separately and doing pay as you earn, if you just keep that payment going for the full period while you're off, or while you're not working, rather, or you're, you know, working in the home versus out of the home in the kind of paid market, if you just keep the payments going, you will just have, at the worst, just payments that didn't count towards PSLF and just a little bit longer loan life, right? So here's an example of this. Let's say that Jillian's numbers was about $100,000 of income, $200,000 of loans, give or take. If she's single, that's a payment of like $600 or $700 a month under something like pay as you earn after deductions. And then let's say Jillian's husband makes about the same income, about $100,000. She's filing separately, then her payment's $700 a month, give or take. And then if she stops working completely, let's say she lives in New York for a second, then that would be a non-community property state, which means that they would have to pay a ton of taxes to file taxes, married filing separately. So in that case, you could just file taxes jointly. And what you could do is you get 3 years worth of forbearance on your loans in total. So she could certainly use, of the 5 years she wants to take off, she could maybe use up all 3 years of forbearance during that period and let the loan grow to avoid making payments of $700 a month. And then for the last 2 years of those 5 years of her kind of in-between period raising kids, she could just file taxes jointly and do $700 a month in payments. And then just know that, you know, your total cost is going to be way cheaper than if she actually paid it back. Now, if she lives in a community property state like California, here's kind of what would happen. So with filing taxes separately, that equalizes your income in community property states. So for example, if she's making 100 and let's say her spouse is making 80, then that's 180 of total income. And then community property state, you divide that income by 2 on each person's tax return. So 90 and 90. But what if she stops working completely? Suddenly you're going to have an income of, if you split it equally, you would take half of the income of the household income. So that's, you know, 80K divided by 2, that's 40K each. So that would make it a little cheaper, honestly, to just give them your tax returns and do pay as you earn and pay like $200 or $300 a month during this period of taking time off, and it'd be totally defensible. Now, the way around that is something called alternative documentation of income. This is kind of a really gray area. There's not really been any determinations as to what's okay and what's not okay with this. But from our interpretation is basically that if you believe that your income is not an accurate reflection on your tax return of your true income, right? So in other words, your tax return income doesn't really mean that's your true income. If you believe that and you're willing to testify to that, then you can use quote unquote alternative documentation of income, which is basically a bunch of list of things, including saying like, I don't have an income right now. And if you equalize your income on your tax return, that eliminates most of the filing separately penalty. And then if you're submitting pay stubs or lack of pay stubs to get a $0 a month payment, you could even avoid doing forbearance during this time and literally pay $0 a month. So that's a very, very complicated case, but it's a perfect illustration of why that you should never let your loans dictate what you're doing with your life. You should always make your life be set up first and then have your loans match your life and not the other way around. That's kind of a classic case where, to make it simple, to try to boil that down to a simple answer, if Jillian just focuses on having a high savings rate and the worst case scenario, if she filed taxes jointly, she would pay a few hundred a month. And is that price worth staying home with your kids? Sure it is. I mean, if that's what's important to her. Now, she can obviously also have to count her lost income and what the net is after deducting for daycare and those kind of things. But that's a complicated situation. So I just want to make things as simple as possible and just say that if I'm trying to bake that question into the theme of the podcast, keeping things simple as they can be. I mean, if it's complicated, it's complicated. And then just not taking an action that you know you want to take. So I guess, for lack of a better word, a sin of omission in Jillian's case would have been if she really wanted to be not working and staying home with her kids and she didn't do that because of her loans. So that would be being overwhelmed by complexity and having a lot of different options that you could choose from, preventing you from being able to navigate a choice and make a choice because you're paralyzed with all these different options. And then you just don't do anything, and that's not good for anybody. So a couple last little things for you today. Really had a good episode. I just wanted to kind of talk about this because I thought it was just a really interesting idea when I was trying to put my money away in Vanguard and just realized, man, this is hard. You know, this is really hard to set up this automatic contribution. And if this is hard for me, it's really hard for everybody else. And how many customers does Vanguard have? Millions. And so that means that millions of people are saving less money because it's so hard to get to the automatic investment button to have Vanguard pull the money out of my bank account every month. You just have to focus on making things simple and taking behavior out of it. If you do that in your financial life, it's going to pay off big time. So if you have questions like Jillian, I want to hear them. Basically, just type in your browser, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and you can record something, 30 seconds, a minute, minute and a half, whatever. Just tell us details about your situation and we'll feature you on the air. And more importantly, I think you're going to help somebody who's going through something that you're probably going through. A couple other points. Refinancing rates right now are the lowest I've maybe ever seen for rates 10, 15, and 20 years. So the fact that you can get a rate lower than 5% in a lot of cases is just absolutely unbelievable for a 20-year term. I mean, I've never seen that before that I can remember. Maybe one other time rates got below that level, maybe like back in, I think, 2016 or something when I started doing this, but it's been a long time. So if you need to refinance, check out studentloanplanner.com/refi, R-E-F-I, And I can confidently say now that we have the best cashback bonuses anywhere on the internet. Our collection of lenders now that we also have, Common Bond and Earnest are the two that a lot of people use. Laurel Road people use, LendKey. I don't want to mention all of them, but also even SoFi now is available through Credible. So our lenders' cashback bonuses, we basically have cashback bonuses that cover like 95% of the refinancing market. And so to kind of eat some of my own medicine, we have like 7 lenders, I think, now on our table. Maybe that's too many. Maybe I should only put like 3 or 4 up so that you'd be forced into making a decision. And maybe that's preventing some of you from taking the action to cut your interest rate and stop paying the government an extra 2% every year on interest for no reason. So if that's causing you to not save money on your student loans, man, maybe I need to do another episode called, you know, Student Loan Planner costs people millions of student loan interest by making it too difficult to refinance your loans on the site. But just know that if you ever do refinance your loans through our links, you've got to make sure you use a brand new email address that's never been used to apply before after clicking that button, which is what tracks you for that cashback bonus. So we do have sometimes people that are like, where's my $500? Generally, that's because you open an account to apply with them already. You know, they don't give double credit out for who referred somebody for a loan. So the way around that, just go to our links and click on that link and just put in a new email address just to make sure that you got tracked correctly. And then you'll get those cashback bonuses and, more importantly, a lower interest rate. And that might not apply to you. Obviously, if you need to go for forgiveness, please make the decision based on math. That's certainly what we do for our clients. Personal note too, I'm going to be taking a little bit of less consulting work in the future. Starting around the end of September, I'm going to be pulling back a lot in terms of the amount of consulting work that I'm going to do. So if you listen to this, definitely book in September because it's going to fill up and there's not going to be any space, I predict, probably by the first week of September. But the reason for that is I want to open up opportunities to promote some of our really amazing consultants, Rob, Jillian mentioned in that question, and then also Lauren and Justin, who are just absolutely crushing it right now and are changing so many lives. And I want to make it so that we can scale this thing better, which means that I need time for content creation, like doing this podcast for you. And if I'm going to do that, then I need to hire more consultants and people that are going to be able to help you. And we're going to always tend to pair the most experienced consultants with the highest debt burdens because these things are really complicated. People with smaller debts, that's a little bit easier. So there's not as much that you can mess up, but man, oh man, $600,000 of student loan debt. There's like six ways from Sunday that you can screw that up. And believe me, we've seen a lot of them. So the last thing that I've got to say is the scholarship. So the scholarship for Student Loan Planner closes September the 30th. We're giving away over $7,000, I think, this year, like 15 scholarships. We only have like six or seven applications right now, which is like crazy. But I guess I'm recording this near the end of August, so that people procrastinate till the last second. So it makes sense. So if you are literally any profession, we probably have a category for you to apply. So to apply, you just need to go to studentloanplanner.com/scholarship. There's all kinds of giveaways, like the investment course and a consult with me, and then cash money, which never hurts. And we're also giving all that money out of our own pocket instead of taking on advertisers, just so we can. I kind of like the idea of feeling the pain a little bit with you on the student loan thing. It's a really freaking big struggle. I just want to help every way that we can. And so thank you so much for what you've done for us in growing our business and trusting us with your financial future and refinancing through our links and telling your friends about the show and leaving reviews on iTunes. That's kind of our way of giving back to our community, is to give, you know, a percentage of our revenues back to the community. Go visit that studentloanplanner.com/scholarship link. And thanks so much. I hope you had a wonderful Labor Day weekend.